happens. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. The FBI is investigating a deadly New Orleans attack as an act of terrorism. President Biden says Shamsuddin Jabbar, a U.S. citizen and Army veteran from Texas, had an ISIS flag on his pickup truck when he struck and killed 15 people on Bourbon Street and injured dozens more. He was killed by police.
A mere hours before the attack, he posted videos on social media indicating that he was inspired by ISIS, expressing a desire to kill.
Authorities say explosive devices were found in the truck and nearby. CBS's Elizabeth Campbell near the attacker's New Orleans Airbnb.
It's been a tough day for a lot of folks here. Around 9 a.m., they had knocks on their doors from officials telling them that they needed to vacate the area. They cleared a couple of blocks around the house in every direction. Folks here have been staying with friends, going for walks. There's a church around the corner that has very graciously opened their doors to folks for charging stations, a restroom. It's still unclear when they're going to get to return to their homes, though.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
The Bucks beat the Pacers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks struggled in the first half, but were able to pull out a 120-112 win on the road over the Indiana Pacers. Doc Rivers on what made the difference in the second half.
Well, you know, at halftime, I thought offensively we didn't play well. I thought we took pretty much bad shots. We turned the ball over, and then the wide open shots we had, we didn't make. And we were down 11. And so I'm thinking at halftime, like, this game can go our way still. I thought the zone turned the game around for us, obviously, defensively. And I thought we fell into two sets, that our spread and our angle, where we spaced the floor open so we can go downhill and make plays. And I thought our passing improved in the second half. And once we start passing to each other, we kept scoring.
College hoops. Number 8th ranked Marquette beat Providence 78-50 in Rhode Island. Cam Jones with 18 points and 10 assists for the Golden Eagles. NFL, the Packers back at practice, preparing to host the Bears on Sunday. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Happy holidays, Walmart shoppers. Yes, your associates are now going to be armed with body cameras. And understand, there have been some retailers, some smaller retailers, who have done this under the guise of, you know, we're just preventing theft. It's a theft prevention tool. Want to make sure that our employees aren't stealing from us. Oh, and you know, maybe the people too. Walmart has taken a different tact. It's not about, you know, spying on their employees. It's not about ensuring that they're not stealing stuff or stealing time or you know, helping people steal or actually other people stealing. No. It's about protecting the associates. Now, here's the thing. This is the weird part. I don't quite know how I feel about that angle. All of the other stuff we know corporate America has done to ensure that we're sufficiently followed, managed, and moved around in their best interests. Making sure that you're doing what you're supposed to do, when you're supposed to do, how, and fast, with constant reminders and all of that. But this safety angle, unique, and for the holidays too. Which is weird because this is the time where we're supposed to smile a little easier, be a little more joyous, have a little bounce in our step, be merry. And yet this is the most stressful period of the year for most people. And unfortunately, too many do take it out on on cashiers and clerks and people who work in retail, which has always been mind-blowing to me why you would take it out on, well, those people, because they're the least able to change anything. If you want to yell at somebody, go find the manager. Go yell at him, not the poor clerk who's just trying to figure out how to get to the end of the day so that they can take their meager paycheck home and maybe figure out how to celebrate the holiday for themselves. But I thought this was a unique angle. Now, Walmart's saying they're only doing it in select places, Dallas right now, but could expand. Could expand. Now, for me, I hope that this will be one of those things that working people go, maybe we should treat other working people with a little more respect, a little more dignity, a little more decently, so that, you know, this doesn't filter down this argument, just protecting our workforce by making sure they're wearing body cameras and we can follow them and track them every minute of the day. So be a little nicer this holiday season. The big story for me today comes from our thin-skinned crybaby in chief. Evidently, Donald Trump has filed a lawsuit against the Des Moines Register. And their parent company, Gannett, and the pollster, that Ann Seltzer, who was a pollster for them for years. According to Donald Trump, those entities, they engaged in brazen election interference because they published a poll that showed him losing Iowa before the November 5th election. And look, is this where we're going? Suing a polling company because they were wrong? That's now the crime? You got this wrong. We're going to sue you out of existence. And again, you know, this is a part of the Fourth Estate. There's some protection here. But oh no. And my first thought when I saw this, I'm going, really? Seriously? Where are my Republican whiners with their frivolous lawsuit chants? Where'd they go? Because this is ludicrous. Suing the Des Moines Register over a poll that was wrong. Wow. But understand, this is an intimidation tactic, you know, through and through. That's what it is. This is what authoritarians do. This is what fascists do. This is what power-hungry, thin-skinned, wannabe dictator, poor sports do. He won. He got his way. And yet, this is about punishing the opposition just a little bit more. And what did our stenographer, corporate-controlled media do? Well, they reported, well, he filed a lawsuit. Like it had merit like any other. And understand, this is our future. Trump is going to continue to weaponize lawsuits. He's going to continue to silence any opposition or any critic. He's going to continue to destroy constitutional protections like the one of the free press. Understand, mere threats from Donald Trump, they're going to have a chilling effect. Mere threats of him using the power of government to revoke licensing or to somehow punish, that's real. And not to mention, throw on top of that, when he calls for the Red Hats to start pursuing some of these non-loyal media types, he's not going to just ruin that journalist's career. He's going to probably ruin their lives. And that's the point. The intent of this is to silence the press. Turn America into North Korea, where only the most glowing reviews ever see the light of day. Where only the most well-written, glorious statements of dear leader get printed. And understand, any deviation of how wonderful dear leader is, that's going to be met with serious consequences. You know, in other countries, even death. Now, thing is, Trump knows he's got the media in this country on the ropes. And he knows. He knows they're going to bow. He knows they're going to bend the knee. Like when the Washington Post and the LA Times pulled their endorsement of Kamala Harris in the 11th hour. He knew. Or when the liberal media heroes of Joe and Mika made their pilgrimage to Mag-a-Lago. he knew. Or here recently, when ABC News settled their defamation suit for $15 million to make nice, he knew. Don't get lulled into thinking that Donald Trump is just a con man shaking down media outlets for cash. He is. He's doing that. But this is far worse. When the Fourth Estate bends its knees, when the Fourth Estate is begging, democracy is dead and dictators rise. That's the reality of the moment that we're in when Donald Trump gets to file a frivolous lawsuit and our corporate-controlled media goes, glad it wasn't us. Learn that lesson. And for all of my friends who have the yard signs still in front of their yard saying, we will walk free and vote for Donald Trump, understand, he will eventually come for you too. Because it's what authoritarians do. Because we know you can never be too loyal to not get thrown out of a window. You can never be not loyal enough to not get poisoned on a park bench or silenced for having an opinion. So all the things that you fear that evil Joe Biden and Kamala Harris was going to do, dear leader, is coming for you. May not be today, but it's going to happen. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Morris Pearl, Patriotic Millionaires, new book, back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you look at the reality of where we are in this country and how inequality has really grabbed us by the throat. And it's no more apparent than when you look at Doge Boy and Jeff Bezos and some of the really wealthy folks in the country. In 2012, Elon Musk was worth $2 billion. Today, almost $500 billion. You look at Bezos, 18, he was worth about 2012, he was worth about $18 billion. Today, almost a quarter of a trillion dollars. Same thing with Zuckerberg. $44 billion in 2012, almost $250 billion in wealth. And the federal minimum wage, 2009, we raised that to $7.25 an hour. And you know what it is today? Same $7.25 an hour. The working folks of this country are not sharing in this enormous wealth. And how do we get there? Well, my next guest has written a book, an important book, one the holidays are coming up, one you might want to run to your favorite bookstore and pick up. Morris Pearl, chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, and John Driscoll have written the book, Pay the People, Why Fair Pay is Good for Business and Great for America. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be on your show, Rick.
So
great to talk about our book.
Yeah, so walk me through the premise here. Pay the people. Something I've been screaming about for a while. You're two rich guys, a healthcare executive, a hedge fund manager. You guys won the game. Why are we saying pay the people?
Well, let me tell you a couple of things. First of all, let me start off with John's story. He was the CEO of CareCentrix. They are a company that dealt with people who had problems paying for their home health care. They had a lot of people answering phones and trying to explain to people how this stuff worked. And he found out some of the people like weren't showing up on time and were sending emails requesting advances on their pay because they didn't have enough money to afford like diapers for their kids or gas money. And what he did is he froze the salaries of himself and a few top people. And he decided the minimum wage for everyone else would be like a little over $30,000 a year. All of a sudden, people were showing up to work. They could afford to put gas in their car and drive to their office. The productivity of the whole company went up. Everything was going well. The company went from like doing poorly to all of a sudden making a lot of money. They end up selling the company and making a huge amount of money for the investors and the executives too. So he made a lot more money because he took a salary freeze, and the other executives too, and paid all the low-wage people much higher salaries. And of course, that was good for them too, but it was also good for the high-paid people. What I've been saying for years is we need a country where everybody makes enough money to get by. And that's just smart business. It's also smart for business owners to want to open their businesses in places where people make enough money to buy stuff. I'm the chairman of a group called the Patriotic Millionaires. And why are we patriotic millionaires? Because we're rich people, because we made a lot of money doing things. And not, we weren't born rich, most of us weren't anyway, but we had businesses selling prom dresses to women who wanted to go to the proms, selling expensive ice cream to guys going on dates with their girlfriends, selling stuff and making money because people had enough money to pay for stuff. As I've always said many times, the guy who owns the bar, he cares a lot more about how much beer money all the people hanging around the bar have than the wages of the one guy standing behind the bar pouring the beer. Now, of course, if he just gave the one guy a raise, that costs him money. But if everybody gets a raise, the bar owner makes a lot more money. Even the people in Seattle, they raise the minimum wage there. People complain, oh my God, I'm going to lose my business.
Sky's falling.
Terrible. Those exact people had to lease bigger spaces because more people wanted to eat out after wages went up. The people complaining about there's no more low-wage jobs. Well, there's no more low-wage jobs because all those people got raises. The people who had low-wage jobs are the same people doing the same work for higher wages. And now everyone, both the people working in the restaurants and the people who own the restaurants, are making more money. It makes sense for everybody.
No, it does. And, you know, it's one of the things I say every time a new president comes into office. My hope for them is that they're the person who figures out a way to return reward to work. And what I mean by that is you go to work and your life gets better. Going to work shouldn't put you into debt, shouldn't be something that you have to borrow gas money to get to. It should make your life better. Work should make your life better. It's one of the things I agreed with Ronald Reagan on. You know, the best anti-poverty program is a job. And I've amended that to say the best anti-poverty program is a good union job that comes with health care and retirement and a reasonable living wage where you earn a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. That used to be who we were as a country, Morris. But that changed. I mean, you know, guys like in your position, you know, help push some of that stuff down. So how's this selling in your neck of the woods?
It's selling well everywhere.
Well, it's not selling well everywhere. Look, I look at the Business Roundtable is not buying, you know, copies of your book. I mean, these are people who are not on board with this yet, and I hope they are some point. Maybe I don't know it, but it doesn't seem to me that there's a consensus in your world of people going, we should be paying those poor working people more.
Well, look at referendum. Where minimum wage was on the ballot to raise the minimum wage, it passes just about every part of the country. The one place it doesn't pass is in the United States Capitol when the members of the United States Senate and the House vote on it. They, frankly, I think they spend too much time dealing with people who are short-term greedy and don't think long-term, because it's short-term thinking that gets people the idea that, oh, we want lower wages that will make more money. Not if you're thinking about how much money you're going to make next year and the year after that and your children and grandchildren. No, it won't. We don't want to live in a country with like half the population living in austerity.
Right.
They tried that in South Africa when I was a teenager. It did not end well for the rich people. I don't want, you know, to wait for the pitchforks in the streets. I want to live in a country where people are living well and people have enough money to buy things and feel secure in their retirement. And those are people who are going to be happy, who are going to shop in stores, who are going to patronize businesses, and who are going to help investors like me and hopefully my children and grandchildren get rich too.
It's interesting you bring up the pitchforks. You're probably 10 minutes away from where Brian Thompson was murdered. No one condones violence. No one celebrates, at least no one should celebrate someone being murdered. But, you know, the response of, you know, little less than empathetic does kind of show where the country is as a whole. And is this something that... you know, the folks in your bracket economically are paying attention to?
I think so. I mean, on one hand, yeah, people are scared. Right in front of my building, there's, you know, police officers all the time. You know, there's guys in Grand Central Station with like assault rifles. God forbid, I don't know what the police officers were going to do with those assault rifles in the crowded train station, yeah. But that's a different point. That's a different question. I think people should be scared. You know, it was years ago when Nick Hanauer wrote his favorite famous piece about pitchforks, but it still applies. And that's part of the reason we got involved with the Patriotic Millionaires, because we don't want to get to that point of pitchforks or even worse, guns.
Yeah.
And that's where we are now.
But here's the thing, you know? And this is where, you know, I look at, you know, back in August of 2019, the Business Roundtable came out with a statement saying that, you know, it was no longer solely about maximizing shareholder wealth. They now cared about all the stakeholders, not just the shareholders. They cared about, you know, the communities, the workers, the, you know, the taxpayers. They cared about all. And it was a really nice, really lovely, well-written piece. And then the pandemic happens and they have an opportunity to prove that, to live those values. And well... during the pandemic, they got a whole lot richer.
True.
And working people got a whole lot poorer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame Jeff Bezos.
I don't blame them either. I blame the system. I don't blame the individual pieces. It's the entire system. So when you're talking about paying the people, I say the way that has to happen are stronger unions, more collective bargaining, more laws that protect workers. As where we're walking into a period with Donald Trump talking about just burning regulations to the ground, I only see things getting worse, which is why I think your book is so very important.
Yeah.
And I hope people will pick this up for Christmas, called Pay the People, Why Fair Pay is Good for Business and Great for America by Morris Pearl and John Driscoll. Find it at your favorite bookseller. But I think that's why this is so important right now.
Yeah, the problem is when one employer employs millions of people, which someplace like Amazon is the major employer in certain places. Walmart is the major employer in certain places. That's a problem. And we need the corresponding thing of a union to deal with them. And I think part of the problem is that some parts of our government, even people who appear to be progressives, sort of feel that people should be dependent on their employers. And sort of don't want unions to be more powerful. And I don't know why. Somehow that's considered a good thing if people like treat their employers more like, you know, benevolent dictators or parents or something. But that's not the way people want to be.
Right.
You want people who have autonomy, who are dealing with their employers on an equal basis. And that means if there's one employer with thousands of people, there should be one union with thousands of people dealing with that employer. And that's why we need something like the PRO Act. We need unions able to deal on an equal basis with employers.
So as you were doing your research for this book, and you and John Driscoll were running through how you were going to present it, was there anything in there that shocked you, anything that made you go, wow, even I didn't know how bad it was?
I mean, some of the things about the Amazon guys who are working on getting their union recognized, or were at the time, I mean, just, I couldn't believe, like, the way they're, like, automated and timed by computers, and like, I couldn't believe people would work like that.
Well, you know, people have insurance.
I never had a regular job.
Yeah, but this is where, you know, I'm glad you've seen this, and why, you know, I'm glad you're shocked by it. But this is the reality of average everyday people. They don't have a choice. And this is where a lot of the right-wing arguments of, well, if you don't like it, you can go across the street. Well, across the street is the same, if not worse, because the entire system is moving into that path of mechanizing work and making everything just, robotic. Look, my wife's going through a healthcare crisis right now. They've turned care into factory work, where there isn't time to spend a moment to see how someone's doing. It's, I got to administer the drugs, I got to go to the next one, I got to take this. We've made jobs without thinking and totally robotic, and we need every metric to ensure that they're doing their job, because we don't trust people either. So it seems, I'm thrilled to hear that you found this and you've put it out there, because I think people need to know that they're not alone in the suffering that they're having.
And I've always said we need to work with people in a trusting relationship, because you can't have a successful business with people you don't trust. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work for the workers. It doesn't work for the owners. It doesn't work for the managers. It doesn't work with, I mean, it's just not fun. Nobody wants to live like that. I used to be an investment banker. My wife told me, you never had a regular job. And I thought, well, yeah, I do. I work hard. But no, I never had a job like that, where people were keeping track of what time I did this and did that. You know, it'd be crazy. But
well, that's the reality of the working class, Morris. That is the reality of, what, 65% of the people in this country who get up every day, punch a clock, and at the end of the week collect a paycheck that doesn't go far enough to keep a roof over their head, food on the table, and be able to do some of the better things. I mean, we're still talking about bread and roses like it was 1912 again. And the sad reality is our political system hasn't gotten there yet, which is why I think books like yours, especially written by folks like you and John Driscoll, so important. And I hope people will pick up Pay the People, Why Fair Pay is Good for Business and Great for America, at your favorite books, especially this holiday. So last line of questioning I've got for you. With all of this information, what's then the call to action? Because you got to have a solution and a pathway forward. What do people do?
Well, the call to action, well, last year we wanted to go to our Congress and get them to raise the minimum wage. That's not working so well now, with the current Congress totally against it. So the call to action is to go to your state legislatures. Parts of the country have minimum wage that's more than double other parts.
Right.
Here in New York, we have a much higher minimum wage, and people are moving to New York and opening businesses in New York, because people in New York can afford to buy stuff and do things. And so we want other parts of the country, like your state of Pennsylvania, to be more like us and raise the wages there too. And you can see the counties on the border between New York and Pennsylvania. You can go and see where there are businesses being created and where even farmers are doing better. Yeah. And they're placed with higher wages, not placed with lower wages.
Because if the right-wing economic theorists were correct, Pennsylvania should be stealing jobs from New York. All of the investment should be into Pennsylvania, where the taxes are lower and the wages are lower. So you're telling me that's not happening.
That's not happened. You can look at counties along the border, Pennsylvania, New York, and Pennsylvania, New Jersey. And the people living in the higher wage places are seeing more businesses, more jobs, more money being spent, and generally a better quality of life. Higher wages, better life.
There you go. No, I think what people should take from this is someone who is the managing director at BlackRock is saying that. someone who is, you know, at the top of the economic heap, at the top of the ladder, someone who has won the game, is saying, look, in order for us to do well, we've got to pay the poor schmuck who's cleaning up after everyone, who's you know, driving the truck and swinging the hammer. We got to pay them more. That's, I think, where the weight is, and where people need to take some stock and also purchase the book, Pay the People, Why Fair Wage, Fair Pay is Good for Business and Great for America, by Morris Pearl and John Driscoll. Morris, great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Wish you and yours the best of the holiday season, and I look forward to seeing you again in the new year.
Thank you. Be here anytime, Rick. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Morris Pearl, chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. Want to hear your thoughts. Is he right? Should we be paying more or no? No. We need those poverty-level jobs that are mechanized and desperate and exploitable. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Scattered evening flurries, otherwise mostly cloudy and a low in the mid-teens. For tomorrow, partly sunny and a high in the mid-20s. Even colder as we look through Friday and the upcoming weekend, highs drop back into the mid and upper teens. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
The excitement.
Oh, he stones Bronczynski with a glove save.
The energy.
What's he going to do? He shoots and he scores.
The tradition.
You've got to understand history if you're ever going to write your own.
It's everything.
He scores. Badgers answer right back.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger hockey.
Sponsored by Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep, Econ Electric, and 8th Street Auto. Listen on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, WFHR, streaming live and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of emails around President Biden doing some pardons, some clemency. Lots of people in my neck of the woods not thrilled with one of them, at least. One of the Cash for Kids judges got something that a lot of my friends up north of me not thrilled with. But there are, I guess it's that time of year where people are going to start petitioning for people to get pardoned, clemency, get their sentences put aside, right some wrongs. That is what we hope to do, because that is what the process is supposed to do. And that's why I've asked my next guest to come share some thoughts. Bob Lord, the Senior Vice President on Tax Policy with the Patriotic Millionaires, also Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. They are now pushing to free Charles Littlejohn, and here to tell me who Charles Littlejohn is, what he did, and why we should be freeing him. I got Bob Lord here with us. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me.
So walk me through who's Charles Littlejohn, what he do, and why we want to free him.
Well, your listeners may remember that in 2020, the New York Times published tax information for Donald Trump over about a 20-year period, and it showed that in, I think, 15 of those 20 years, he paid virtually no tax, and in many years, no tax.
Right.
And then in 2021 and 2022, ProPublica published a lot of information about billionaires in America avoiding huge amounts of tax. Well, Charles Littlejohn is the IRS contractor who provided that information to the New York Times and ProPublica. He did break the law. He pled guilty to one count, and the recommended sentence was 4 to 10 months. The judge, a Biden appointee, sentenced him to 5 years, the absolute maximum.
Wow.
And in her sentencing opinion, she said that what he did to President Trump was an attack on America's constitutional democracy, and she equated it to the actions of the January 6th insurrectionists.
Really?
It was a gross miscarriage of justice, Rick.
Wow, because I've still got the images of the January 6th criminals, you know, stabbing policemen with metal poles and flags. I still have the sounds of policemen being crushed in doors. I didn't hear anything from Charles Littlejohn.
It's hard to comprehend. I should note that this sentence was issued after the judge received a letter from 25 Republican congressional representatives urging her to be harsh in her sentencing.
Very interesting. And look, you know, ultimately what we're doing is we're protecting the billionaire class in this country from the reality of pulling back the curtain of how bad our tax policies are and how a lot of these guys, from Elon Musk all the way down, have walked away from their responsibility to this country. They've taken all that we can offer. They've taken all that this country has to give, and they've put it in their pockets. And it doesn't seem to me that, well, I know we like using that fair share thing, but it doesn't seem like they're even paying a share.
These revelations in ProPublica really opened up everyone's eyes to what's going on with these billionaires on the tax front. Elon Musk paying zero in federal income tax in 2018. Jeff Bezos, 2 years where he paid zero. Warren Buffett, an overall income tax rate of 0.1% on his economic income. Peter Thiel, you know, who basically created the career of J.D. Vance. Peter Thiel stashed $5 billion in a Roth IRA. He will never pay income tax on that $5 billion. All these absolutely gross abuses were revealed. And just think, Rick, what if Littlejohn had instead leaked the tax records of a bunch of bartenders and hairstylists who weren't reporting all their tip income? You think he would have been sentenced for 5 years? I really doubt it.
No, I'm not a betting person, but I think I'd bet on that. I think I'd bet you were right. But here's the part that gets me. And I want to reiterate the fact that, you know, none of these people broke the law. Bezos, Musk, what they've done is they've rigged the system to the point where the system is broken. And this is the same thing I talked about with the murder of the United Health Group CEO. It's a shame. I don't condone violence. It's a shame that this person was murdered. It's a shame that the person who shot him is going to spend the rest of their life in jail. But it's not going to change anything because the system is broken and badly broken, much like our tax system is so badly broken. So, you know, this guy just gave us a glimpse into what reality was. So I can easily justify letting this guy go, because he's already served what was the original intent of his sentence, right?
Well, by the time Biden leaves office, he'll have served over 8.5 months of the maximum recommended guideline sentence, the sentencing guidelines of 10 months. And President Biden has the power to commute his sentence. We want everybody to write a letter to President Biden urging that he do this. And we've created a website to make it really easy to do that. It's freecharleslittlejohn.com. You can go to the site and there is you can click to send an email, or you can copy the letter and put it on your own paper and send it by snail mail. No. Either one will work.
No, freecharleslittlejohn.com. We'll get links out on social media. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, wouldn't whistleblower status play into this something? Because, you know, ultimately we did find some things that were wrong that, you know, I do believe that, you know, we should be looking into. I mean, anything along that lines?
No, there's nothing that, that protects him from prosecution. And my organization, the Patriotic Millionaires, we're not urging a pardon here. He pled guilty. The criminal conviction is fine. It's just the sentencing is just completely out of whack.
So just let him out of jail. Let him go back to leading his life and pick up the pieces and move forward. That's the request. And it seems
exactly.
It seems logical. It seems reasonable. Look, you did the crime. You did what was the agreed upon time. And now, see, this is the thing that gets me with some of these sentencing guidelines. that judicial discretion can go both ways, can it?
It can. And in this case, it was extreme. The logic, this is how bad the logic was, Rick. The judge said that what he did was by leaking Trump's tax records. Remember, every president from Nixon to Obama had voluntarily released their tax information. She said it was an attack on our constitutional democracy for him to leak that information to the New York Times. Well, now think about that. If it was an attack on our constitutional democracy for him to leak it to the Times, she's implicitly saying that the Times was involved in attacking our constitutional democracy. That's quite an allegation to make against one of our most venerable media outlets.
So were they held accountable? Did we lock anybody
up
there?
They're protected. The freedom of the press protects the Times in this situation.
Even from the bedrock of destroying our Constitution?
Well, that's the question. I mean, if you're going to look at it this way, as she did, then that protection could easily be questioned. And do we want that? Do we want a situation where when a news outlet gets information that's vital to the public to know, and they have to worry about whether they could be criminally charged?
Look, I think he went into this knowing that he was breaking the law. I got to think that. I got to think he knew what he was doing. He's a big boy. I got to think he knew that there could be something. 5 years seems really excessive.
Well, by comparison, criminal tax evaders who have cheated the government out of millions have not received sentences anywhere near that big. There was a case just this year where several, I forget whether they're contractors, employees of Department of Homeland Security, had taken the information of 200,000 Americans and sent it to a software developer in India for a profitable venture that they were going to profit from. Those three people got sentences of 4 months, 8 months, and 2 years probation. Didn't even have any prison time at all.
So did Charles Littlejohn have a lawyer? I mean, because it sounds like maybe he just had a bad lawyer.
No, he had a very good lawyer.
Because if all these other guys are getting off, maybe it comes back to just like you said, 25 Republicans sent a letter to the judge. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. No, it was... I don't think it was his lawyer. I don't think any lawyer could have achieved a different result.
Yeah. So the website, freecharleslittlejohn.com, go send the letter. But ultimately, Bob, as I've been saying for a long time, these isolated instances, they don't change much. We learned a little bit of information, and I'll bet right now you could go on the streets and you could ask people what it was. And I'll be honest with you, I had forgotten who Charles Littlejohn was, and thank you for reminding us. The system to me is just so badly broken, so much garbage in, garbage out, that I think we've all kind of given up. So the question that I have for you, as a tax guy, is there hope, especially now that you've got Trump coming in with his merry band of CEOs going to deregulate and slash taxes for rich people? Any hope here?
Well, in the next 4 years, no. But ultimately, I think whatever hope there is, it is greater, significantly greater, because of what Charles Littlejohn did. There is information. I use information in what I write about tax policy. I use information from those ProPublica articles routinely.
But I do want to go back to the main point that I take out of this. Nothing that Bezos or Musk or any of those, Donald Trump even, nothing they did was illegal, right?
As far as we know, there was, I don't remember any reports in the New York Times or ProPublica about about tax evasion. It was just very aggressive tax avoidance activities.
And for me, that's the story in this, that our system is so badly broken that the ones we've given the most to, the ones who have gotten the most out of this country, the ones who have grabbed the quarter and squeezed it till the eagle screams, they're the ones who walk away with paying, contributing the least back into what they've benefited from. And I think that is a story and one to be grateful to Charles Littlejohn for, to pull back that curtain.
Exactly. You know, and in some cases, they're not even aggressive, these billionaires. You know, take, for example, Elon Musk. His wealth has increased by, I think, about $200 billion since the election. That $200 billion increase in his wealth will not be subject to income tax unless and until he starts selling stock in Tesla or SpaceX or any other corporation that he owes stock in. And what these tax records showed is how little income tax they paid on these enormous increases in wealth that we all knew about.
So how is it different now than it was, say, 60 years ago? Why is now different than then? You know, because I've had people say, well, you know, we've always had rich people, Rick. There have always been really, really rich people and really, really poor people. We're not a Marxist society. How is it different in the past? How is it, you know, we didn't have, you know, did we have the Elon Musks in the 50s and 60s?
You know, it wasn't perfect in the past, but we had a top rate of 91% during the Eisenhower administration. We had a much more significant rate on capital gains. We tax dividends at a much, much higher rate than we do now. And the proof is that between 1946 and 1970, the share of the nation's wealth held by those at the very top actually shrank. Since 1980, it's exploded.
Yeah.
The top 0.01% of the country, about 30,000 Americans, they hold over 10% of the country's wealth. Their share of the country's wealth has quadrupled in the last 40 years.
Yeah, and look, you know, our national debt has exploded. And I argue our national debt exploding was just, you know, a redistribution of wealth from we the taxpayers to, well, the billionaire class that we have so well created and made, you know, wealthy in their own right. This is where a lot of our debt, I believe, came from, because we're not collecting those tax dollars to pay for the things we need.
Right. Instead of getting the tax dollars, we borrowed the dollars from this class, and they're sitting there with bonds.
And we're paying them interest.
For what should have been tax payments.
We're paying them interest for what they should have been paying us. It really is. It's quite remarkable. It's a great gig if you can get it, isn't it?
Oh, it really is.
Problem is you and me, we ain't getting it. we're getting the short end of that stick. So lastly, freecharleslittlejohn.com, what do you want people to do?
I want people to go to the site, send an email to President Biden, send a letter to President Biden, and have all your friends and all your relatives do the same thing. Maybe, just maybe, if he gets a couple thousand letters and emails, it will get his attention.
There you go. Bob Lord, I appreciate the time. Best to you and to yours this holiday season, and look forward to talking to you again in the new year.
Thanks. You as well, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Lord. Again, make sure you check out the website, freecharleslittlejohn.com. We'll get links out on social media. I'll take a quick break. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day that Congress passed the 18th Amendment, which outlawed the transportation, manufacture, and sale of alcohol. The amendment went into effect 13 months later. According to John Rumbarger, author of Profits, Power, and Prohibition, the temperance movement centered on tightening social control of working people. Workers often met in bars and saloons to unwind after work and to socialize. But in the days before union halls, the saloon also doubled as a headquarters where workers could talk about problems on the job, like mistreatment and poor working conditions. They used the saloon as a place to plan and organize strikes. It also served as a site for workers to talk politics and organize around political parties. Many prominent industrialists complained that saloons were breeding grounds for labor unrest and radical politics. They also feared a growing immigrant working class that tied its fate to powerful political machines like those in Chicago, New York, and Boston. The anti-saloon movement brought a strange mix into its coalition. It included the KKK, who worried of the growing power of immigrant workers. But it also included progressives, who worked for labor harmony and sobriety as a means of public health. The anti-saloon movement also targeted German brewers. The United States had just entered World War I, and anti-German sentiment was so high that many considered German breweries to be working for the Kaiser, their product a sap on the energy of servicemen and grain production to feed the U.S. troops. But alcohol flowed freely throughout the 1920s, creating both the jazz speakeasy and bootlegging syndicates. It would ultimately be repealed by 1933.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, you know, I want to highlight that, you know, our systems are sadly broken. And this is one of those things where the hope is that, you know, as bad things happen, and they're going to, you know, Doge Boy and Vivek, they're going to have their horrible ideas, slash and burn government down to the bone, to where it's going to hurt a lot of people. And, you know, the hope out of this pain, because we know it's coming, there's no stopping this. You know, the empathetic, compassionate part of me, you know, wants to rush in and go, no, we can stop this. We can stop the pain. We had a chance, November 5th. That's done. It's now damage control time. How are we going to stop the insanity? How are we going to, how are we going to use the pain and the suffering that's coming in a way that's going to ensure that maybe people in the future don't have to suffer? Because our systems are broken. You know, as I talked to with Bob Lord, you know, our tax code's broken, our healthcare systems are broken, and it got me thinking today. You know, as I was preparing for today's show, the mail came to our home. And I, so far, my wife's been in the hospital about almost 14 weeks. And the bills are coming. I gotta share, you know, this is about, these are all the EOBs and bills and all kinds of stuff from just 2.5 months. Literally weighs about 10 pounds. About almost 5 inches thick. But the one that caught my attention the most, that highlights to me the most, is this one. This is from 22 days that my wife spent in something called an LTAC, a long-term acute care facility. This is where you go, it's like a step-down kind of ICU. It's where you go before you go to a rehab hospital, because that's the flow chart. So for 22 days, the hospital, this LTAC, charged what was almost $550,000. You go, oh my God, what did they do? $550,000 for 22 days. That's more than 24 grand a day. So I get the bill and I'm like, holy wow, look at this, look at this. Oh my gosh, what a wow. You know, who can pay this? This is why our system's broken. So I get the EOB, the explanation of benefit, from my insurer. And, you know, immediately my eyes are awakened by the number of zeros that I see. Because I have the very best health insurance that you can probably get, thanks to my Teamsters Union. The Central Pennsylvania Teamsters Health and Welfare Fund does an amazing job by me and my family, and it's something I wish every person had. But when they sent me this explanation of benefits for the $550-some thousand, I notice
they paid just about $92,998.02. That's what they paid. I'm responsible for none of it. And because it was in network, saved almost $440,000. $440,000 got written off. Now, look, I go, you know, good for me. You know, I'm lucky. Thank goodness. But then my mind went to, what about those who aren't so lucky? What about those people who they weren't fortunate enough to be in network because there was nothing around? What about those people who didn't have enough health insurance? What about those people who had co-insurance and giant deductibles and all of this stuff? Or like I said, none whatsoever. These 22 days, almost $550,000. And this isn't all the bills from that period. This is just the hospital's portion. In fact, a hospital inside a hospital, to where if she needed to actually go to the hospital, would have to be discharged from the LTAC hospital to go into the actual hospital. You figure it out. Hedge fund managers have, because it's all about how we get people to pay this kind of money. Now, understand, the game is played in a couple of different ways, because I was thinking, well, why is it this way? If they're only going to pay, you know, 20% of the bill, you know, $550,000, they're going to pay 100, you know, not even 100. Yeah. How can they do that? Well, first and foremost, we know that unfortunately most people don't have enough health insurance, and this is a giant tax dodge. They're going to write a bunch of their profits off. They're going to write a bunch of it off. It's going to fall under the back of the taxpayers. And it's an accounting gimmick. So when I almost had the heart attack looking at the bill, well, you know, I'm going to be okay. And then the other part of it, the more nefarious, the worst part of it for me is, let's say you didn't have enough health insurance, but you owned a home. Do you think that person's going to get the $92,998.02 bill that I got? Or are they going to get the $550,000 bill? And then they'll graciously give you a 10% discount. And this is where my mind goes into just how bad our system is. Was the hospital bad? No, they were good. Were the workers bad? No, they were doing their jobs. Everybody in this system is part of the cog, is a wheel, part, you know, part of the cog in the wheel. It's the wheel that's broken. It's the system that we've allowed to be propped up with hedge fund managers and bean counters thinking about healthcare as a for-profit industry instead of as a care industry. Because I got to be honest, as good as people have been, the care, in my view, has been subpar. And I understand, I get that the nurses and the CNAs and all of the staff are still burnt out from the pandemic. I completely get that. And I get that as a society, we've gotten much harder and much harsher to each other. I get that. But what happened to the care in healthcare when everything's done for a profit? And as I've told the story before, I'm in a weird spot because my insurer, our health and welfare fund, actually went to bat to keep my wife in the hospital where the doctor wanted to discharge her weeks ago, while agreeing that the hospital is where she should be. This is how weird and how broken our system is. Now, do I think something wrong with the doctor or with the people? No. I think they've been trained into a system that is, again, badly, badly broken. And it's not going to get any better in the next 4 years. If anything, this broken healthcare system is going to get much more lopsided to where working people are going to continue to get screwed over, especially people in rural America. As Doge Boy and the rest of those clowns go after Medicaid, understand that's poor people. That's rural people. That's folks at the bottom of the end of the economic spectrum. That's you and me. So for me, the lesson in all of this, especially during the holiday season, is how do we start thinking about each other again, especially during this time? How do we make sure that everyone gets access to the best health care, to the best opportunity of survival? Not just those of us like me, fortunate enough to have really good insurance. It should be about care, not about the card in your wallet. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The New Year's party on Bourbon Street in New Orleans turned deadly when the driver of a pickup truck slammed into the crowd, killing 15 people and injuring dozens more. Shamsuddin Jabbar, a U.S. citizen from Texas, was killed when he and police exchanged gunfire. President Biden saying,
"Mere hours before the attack, he posted videos on social media indicating that he was inspired by ISIS, expressing a desire to kill."
CBS's Katie Weiss in New Orleans.
Jim Maurer was visiting from Iowa. He said after the gunfire stopped, he tried to help the victims.
People we came across were unfortunately deceased.
The FBI says an ISIS flag was located in the truck, as were weapons and other potential explosive devices. Law enforcement also identified possible IEDs located in the French Quarter.
It's being investigated as an act of terrorism, and FBI thinks he might.